Today at Reader's Corner, we talk to Brendan Koerner, author of The Skies Belong to Us, Love and Terror in the Golden Age of Hijacking. I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Over a five-year period, starting in 1968, petty criminals and protesters, decorated veterans, and the occasional used car salesman seized commercial jets nearly once a week. With visions of ransom money, fame, or merely escape to exotic locales, these hijackers changed the course of modern travel and transportation security. In this encore edition of Reader's Corner, we talk with author and journalist Brendan Koerner about his book, The Skies Belong to Us, Love and Terror in the Golden Age of Hijacking. In the book, Koerner takes us through a particularly violent era in our history, occurring right overhead. Focusing his lens on two unlikely hijackers, Koerner follows the two-decade trail of a Vietnam veteran and a rural track star who escaped with nearly $500,000 on a fugitive flight that took them around the globe. Brendan Koerner is a contributing editor at Wired and has written for the New York Times, Slate, Mother Jones, and many other publications. He's the author of Piano Demon and Now the Hell Will Start, the latter of which he is currently adapting for filmmaker Spike Lee. Brendan Koerner, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Well, thank you for having me.
Brendan, I've got to start with How the Hell Will Start. That's pretty impressive, first of all, that you've got Spike Lee working on this. When are we going to see this movie?
Hopefully the not-too-distant future. I've written multiple drafts of the screenplay. We're pretty happy with where it's at. It's really a matter in that industry of getting someone to put up the money to film what could be a pretty big production. So Spike recently had a big hit with Black Klansman, and hopefully that's going to give him some influence to round up the budget necessary to make that movie.
Yeah, well, good luck on that one. It looks like it's the story of a soldier who flees, but the real story is the African-American issue in World War II. Is that correct?
Yeah, so it's basically about the fact that black draftees in World War II were often used as laborers, manual laborers in a segregated Jim Crow military. And mm-hmm. I use the story of one of them, a man named Herman Perry from Washington, D.C., who was shipped around the globe to the Indo-Burmese border to work on a road through the jungle and kind of this quixotic quest to supply our Chinese allies. And some pretty nasty things ensue, and he ends up fleeing into the jungle and actually marrying into a tribe of headhunters called the Naga.
Now, that sounds like a yarn, if I've ever heard one. And I'll remind our listeners, if they want to get the book, it's How the Hell Will Start, One Soldier's Flight from the Greatest Manhunt of World War II. But we're here to talk about a different issue, and that's skyjacking. And as I was telling you, Brendan, before we got into this interview, I lived through all of these years of skyjacking. In fact, my wife was a flight attendant for American Airlines at the time. And yet, I have to say, reading this really awakened me to some things that I guess I just wasn't paying much attention to back in the day. Let's start with some basics, if we could. Let's take the time frame that I believe you suggest at the beginning of your book, 1961 to 1972. How many commercial U.S. flights were hijacked?
159 in American airspace. And like any kind of epidemic, really, it kind of intensified and accelerated over time. So the real bulk of the hijackings took place in the latter few years of that time period. When I kind of plotted the hijackings on a chart, I saw that the ebb and flow of them really mimicked that of a viral epidemic. I really looked at, for example, the spread of SARS several years back and then epidemic and how you kind of have a small cluster of cases and they fall off and then it comes roaring back and the virus mutates and changes over time. And that kind of happened with the skyjackings where you had the stated motives and the techniques of the skyjackers changed. You'd have a batch of hijackings that would be carried out in a certain manner with a certain destination in mind or a certain objective, and they'd kind of be addressed or they would fall off. People would think we'd emerge victorious over this problem, and they'd come roaring back in a new fashion. There'd be some kind of new twist to the way people were carrying these out. So it was very much like a viral epidemic in terms of its ebb and flow and its intensification over time.
And I get the impression that some of these were almost skyjackings that wound up creating folk heroes and creating in the minds of potential skyjacker the fame and the fortune that goes with this. And I don't know, I'm not going to pronounce his name right, but Rafael Minichiello or something like that. If you could just tell his story, because I think anybody who is just, you know, off kilt enough to consider skyjacking listens to this story, I guess you can see how it turns into a virus.
Yeah, absolutely. So Rafael Minichiello was Italian-born U.S. Marine who fought in Vietnam. And upon his return to the U.S., believed the Marines owed him, I think it was $800 in back pay. And the Marines claimed it was only $600. And there was a big dispute over this discrepancy. And so one night, Minichiello got drunk and broke into the base store where he was living and stole $200 worth of merchandise, mostly wristwatches, thinking this would settle the score between him and the Marines. Of course, the Marines tried to court-martial him for this, and he decided to flee back to his native Italy, where he thought that the populace would understand how there had been a slight to his honor in this dispute with the Marines, and he was justified in what he had done. So he basically hijacked a plane out of Los Angeles and directed it to be flown all the way back to Rome. And this was actually the first time a hijacker in America had asked to go somewhere other than Cuba. Cuba, up until then, had been the sole destination for these hijackings. All of a sudden, Minichiello was saying, I want to go to Europe, to Rome specifically. When he lands there, he is arrested, but he becomes a folk hero in Italy. And he's held up as someone who has stood in opposition to American warmongering, American imperialism. And in fact, he ends up only being sentenced to, I believe, 18 months in jail in Italy, serves only a fraction of that. And when he gets out, he's really held up as a sex symbol, and he's offered a contract to appear in a spaghetti Western.
Let's talk about the role that the airlines play in this. There were moments, as you described some of these skyjackings, when I came away with the impression that the pilots were quick to abide by whatever the demands of the skyjacker were, and there wasn't any pushback whatever, and maybe that's the way it had to be. But I wonder if you could address that in terms of the conflict between the FBI that was trying to get these guys and nail them for what they did, and sometimes the pilots and the airlines, which were just giving away planes and sending these guys wherever they wanted to go.
Yeah, this is maybe the most surprising thing to me is that pretty early on this epidemic, the airlines had to make a choice. They basically ran cost-benefit analysis on this hijacking problem. So you have to keep in mind there was no security at this time in airports. You could basically walk from the curb to the top of the boarding stairs with no ID, not showing anyone a ticket. No one checks your carry-on luggage or your person. And so the airlines are facing these hijackings, and they run the calculus and say, well, we can spend millions and millions of dollars implementing security, maybe scare off some passengers who don't want to be treated like criminal suspects just because they're trying to travel somewhere. Or we can put up with like 20 to 30 hijackings a year. What we'll do is we'll just comply with everything the hijackers want, which at that time was basically just going to Cuba early on. You know, we'll have to spend some extra money on giving free tickets to the passengers who are inconvenienced. We'll have to pay some fees in Cuba to get our plane back. But in the long run, it's significantly cheaper for us to just put up with a certain number of hijackings per year, comply with all of the demands so everyone's safe, than to spend vast fortunes on implementing security. And so they basically mandated for their flight personnel that comply with everything the hijacker wants. That's the safest, easiest, cheapest way for us to deal with this problem is just go along with what they want. People will be diverted. They'll lose a day of their lives being put up in a hotel in Havana or what have you. Maybe later on we'll pay some ransom, which you usually get back because most of these hijackers are apprehended. And this is the much more economically beneficial solution for the airlines than implementing security. So that was their thought process on this. Right. And that's why they have this policy of maximum cooperation with hijackers.
Yeah, it was really frustrating reading the various accounts of these skyjackings, and you'd get to one after the other, and it would be some guy carrying a weapon on board. And of course, when we look at that today, given the restrictions and the security screening that we have, it's mind-boggling to think there was a time when the airlines wouldn't do something about that. And that's where I want to go with this next question. Congress obviously did during this period hold some hearings, considered screening, and you might share with us what the airline position was in those early days on efforts to get screening.
Yeah, these are fascinating. Looking at the transcripts of those hearings, the airlines would go before these Senate committees and they basically say, look, there's no way on earth we can have security, because if we do that, we're going to have lines that snake around the airport. And
they were right about that.
Yeah, but they basically argued that air travel would be destroyed. that basically no one would be able to get on the planes, they would not be able to get, you know, adhere to schedules, and that this great new convenience of mass affordable air travel would be lost to the American public. So that was their argument. And there was this sense of implementing any kind of security would really slash the number of people willing to spend money on airline tickets.
Mm-hmm. So where else did these hijackers want to take these planes besides Cuba? And of course, you gave us the example of Italy.
Yeah, so after Minichiello's hijacking in 1969, people start requesting to go all sorts of places. They want to go to North Korea, Sweden, Argentina. There was a successful hijacking down there. And of course, the one I write about, In the Skies Belong to Us, which is really the main focus of the book, the destination they wanted was Algeria.
Well, one of the solutions, and again, I'm sorry, but I don't think the airlines come off looking very smart during this era. But one of the suggestions that they come up with is, hey, we've got an idea. Let's give passengers free one-way flights to Cuba.
Sure. So this is one of the proposals that was taken very seriously. So, you know, this, of course, was after Castro's revolution. Air travel had been cut off, direct air travel, at least, to Cuba. And so the airlines thought, well, you know, maybe if we just gave anyone who wanted a free one-way ticket to Cuba, this would solve the problem. We just get a few plane loads of these folks who want to go live in this supposed socialist paradise, and we'll dump them off there, and that'll get rid of all the hijackers. So that was actually seriously considered and debated, never really quite followed through on, like a lot of ideas that were kicked around during this time.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Brendan Koerner, author of The Skies Belong to Us. So let's talk about those folks who went to Cuba. What happened to them? You talked about, and of course, everyone, certainly the hijackers, thought they were going to the socialist paradise. How'd that work out for them?
Yeah, generally not too well. Generally, there were two fates that awaited the hijackers who went down there. Upon landing, they would be interrogated by the secret police, who would make a determination whether these people posed a threat to law and order in Cuba. The majority, they decided, were kind of harmless, a lot of kooks, a lot of idealists. So they would kind of put them up in this dormitory in South Havana, and they would basically just live there and eke out an existence. And a lot of them ended up being fed up with the Spartan lifestyle and the difficulties of what they had to face, and ended up begging to come back to the U.S. and would come back here on freighters via Canada and be arrested. And a lot of them preferred that to live in poverty in Cuba. A small number of these hijackers, however, were determined by the secret police to be dangerous. And they were actually imprisoned in these horrible gulags where they were forced to harvest sugarcane in the rural areas of Cuba. And there are some real horror stories about violence and torture that took place in those gulags. So yeah, very few of them found the utopia they were looking for.
So I want to get to the case of Roger Holder and Kathy Kirkow in a minute, but before we get there, I wonder if you could comment on what the penalties were for those who you just described, went to Cuba or somewhere, decided that wasn't such a hot deal, so they came back to the United States. Is there any way to summarize or give us the average length of time somebody would be thrown away in the pokey for hijacking?
Yeah, sure. They were generally quite light sentences, actually, I found. You would have people generally came back via Canada. They'd cross the border in Plattsburgh, New York, and be apprehended there. And then generally they were sentenced to like 3 to 5 years in prison. So remarkably light sentences, certainly pale in comparison to what people receive for those crimes today.
I think you have a quote in the book focused on the skyjackers themselves. The quote is, "He must express himself in some way or he wouldn't hold his self-respect." And I guess it raises the question of, I mentioned in the intro, who some of these characters were, but is there a profile that comes to mind as to the average hijacker, I guess you could say?
Yeah, this was a really challenging thing for me to address in the book, because looking at these 159 incidents and the various characters involved in them, they all had different backgrounds, came from different walks of life, had different stated motives for what they were doing. And so I kind of had to find out what was the common thread throughout all of these individuals who decided to do this incredibly bold and rash and audacious crime. And what I found is that when you scratch me at the surface of whatever their stated motives were, political or otherwise, you found these were all people who had kind of desperate personal circumstances. These are often people who had experienced some kind of hardship in life, had not received help, mental health assistance, or they were in financial straits, they hadn't received help. They'd had romantic relationships go awry. A lot of them were veterans who were experiencing maybe post-traumatic stress disorder that was undiagnosed. And a lot of them just felt cornered by circumstance and felt that they had reached a dead end in their lives. And they had to do something incredibly bold to change their fortunes. And there was kind of this behavioral virus in the air of hijacking as a way to do that.
So those of us who are familiar with going through an airport today usually think that it was 9/11 that really seriously enhanced the security that we all have to deal with now when we go to an airport, and I don't object to that at all. But of course, there was security before then, so what turned the tide from the early days when people were just walking into airports and getting right on the plane, no checks or anything, to the point where there was some security finally provided?
Yeah, there was actually a specific hijacking that was the tipping point for all this. Throughout 1972, these hijackings had become increasingly crazy and violent. There were deaths of passengers and law enforcement personnel and hijackers themselves. And so these were becoming tougher and tougher for the public to put up with. And yet still the airlines kind of resisted calls for security until, you know, early November 1972, there was a hijacking of a Southern Airways flight in Mississippi by three men, and they demanded that they wanted $10 million. And they said if they didn't get $10 million, they were going to crash the plane into the uranium-235 reactor that was at Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee. And this was a moment when the authorities and the airlines realized, wait a second, there's a potential here for planes being used as weapons of mass destruction. And really, the liability issues associated with that would destroy the aviation industry. And so it really became the cost-benefit analysis finally swung in the direction of security is the wiser option because of potential liability issues associated with planes being crashed into nuclear reactors and causing, you know, minor Armageddon in states.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Brendan Koerner, author of The Skies Belong to Us. In the book, Koerner describes the five-year period starting in 1968 when commercial jets were hijacked nearly once a week. You know, I don't think this interview coming out of the Pacific Northwest could survive without mention of D.B. Cooper, the folk hero, you might say, of Northwest Airlines, I believe it was. Could you just give us a rundown of that particular incident?
Yeah, well, I'll give you my opinion. So D.B. Cooper was a man who hijacked a plane in the Pacific Northwest, demanded money, and then actually jumped out of the plane with a parachute and was really never seen again. They never recovered a body. They never apprehended anyone for the crime. Many years later, there were pieces of the cash that he had been given were found on the forest floor in the forest along the border. But there's this mystery of who he was. What happened to him, he has become a pop culture phenomenon in a lot of ways. And lots of people who are obsessed with the case, and many people have claimed to have solved it over the years. I am of the mind that he didn't know what he was doing. He basically jumped out of this plane going at a high rate of speed into a pounding hailstorm, wearing, you know, a business suit, basically, wingtips with a non-steerable parachute. My personal belief is that he died on the way down, landed on top of some huge fir tree where his body was picked apart by buzzards, and that's why he was never discovered.
That makes sense to me. So let's talk about Roger Holder and Kathy Kirkow. It would be hard for a novelist to make up the story of Roger Holder and Kathy Kirkow. We may just be able to conclude this interview, Brendan, without giving away what happens to both of them. Because whenever I talk to authors who have novels, I always tell them, I said, we're not going to give away the plot. We're just going to talk about the book and the people in it. So let's start out with that. And maybe I will have you comment at the end on where you think Kathy Kirkow is, because that's just too cool. Tell us about Roger Holder and Kathy Kirkow, where they came from and how they met, and then we'll go from there.
Sure. So Roger Holder was an African-American soldier, a Vietnam veteran, from a military family. His dad had been in the Navy and came back from Vietnam. And kind of like Rafael Minichiello, Holder felt hard done by the Army, felt he'd been mistreated in Vietnam. He'd actually been briefly imprisoned for marijuana possession while in Vietnam. So he went AWOL from the Army upon returning to the States, ended up living in San Diego, kind of being a beach bum, sort of living under an assumed identity, you know, basically the hippie lifestyle. Kathy Kirko was from a small town in Oregon, Coos Bay, Oregon, on the coast. Beautiful town, perhaps best known as the hometown of Steve Prefontaine, who was a friend of hers in high school, in fact, the great distance runner. And she had moved down to San Diego to hang out with a friend and kind of also live this hippie lifestyle. One day, Roger Holder came to the door of her apartment, looking actually for her roommate, who he knew slightly. And they ended up kind of talking for a little bit. And they realized that, you know, their paths had actually crossed when they were children. Very briefly, Roger Holder's family had lived in Coos Bay for 3 months. There was a naval station up there, an old naval station. His father had been assigned there. They'd actually been one of the very few black families in town. And in fact, Roger Holder's brother had been the victim of a racist attack in a schoolyard in Coos Bay. And that's why the family had to leave Coos Bay. And during that time, he'd briefly crossed paths with Kathy Kirko. And so this coincidence made Roger, who was a big fan of astrology and fortune telling, think that this must be the cosmos way of telling him that he and Kathy were meant to do something spectacular and history making together. And so he starts to make plans of what that might be. And he decides ultimately that he's going to, with Kathy, hijack a plane and use the hostages, the passengers, to obtain the freedom of the radical academic and activist Angela Davis, who was then on trial in San Jose in federal court for her alleged role in what had been a violent attack on a courthouse.
She had no idea that these two were trying to help her, like she didn't even need it or want it.
No idea, yeah. And wanted nothing to do with them. So it surprised her as much as it surprised the rest of America that this young couple hijacked this plane and was demanding that she be brought to the San Francisco airport wearing a white dress and that she would be taken on board in exchange for the hostages. So that was his plan, that he wanted to take Angela Davis actually to North Vietnam. And in doing so, he thought that this would be an act of contrition on his part and show that he felt bad about the role he'd played in the war and the people he'd killed as a soldier in the American Army.
But they wind up in Algiers, and I wonder if you could share with us how they managed to get there. I believe they had to refuel. As I was reading these refueling moments, I'm thinking, this is where they can get these guys. And it doesn't happen. They refuel, and they're off again. Please tell the story.
So Roger Holder made a lot of detailed plans for this, but one he neglected to make was he neglected to hijack a plane with the range capable to reach North Vietnam. He hijacked a Boeing 727, which is a short to medium distance plane, which really cannot even really get to Hawaii from California, let alone all the way to Vietnam, even with refueling stops. So he needed to switch planes. So he demanded a new plane, which was brought to him, a Boeing 720. And kind of in the middle of all this, he figures, you know what, like so many things have gone wrong in this hijacking. This must be a sign from the cosmos that I'm not meant to go to Vietnam. And he kind of makes a decision on the fly without consulting Kathy that they're going to go to Algiers instead.
And so how do things go in Algiers for them?
Not as they expected. So Algiers at that time, you have to understand, in Algeria was a little bit like, I guess, Venezuela today, and the fact that it was like an anti-Western revolutionary socialist government, but also one that did a lot of business with the West selling energy, selling oil and gas. But a lot of radical political groups, like the Viet Cong, for example, or the PLO, had been invited to set up shop in Algiers by the president, the dictator of the country. And one of the groups that had been invited was the Black Panthers. The Black Panthers had an outpost there led by the famous Eldridge Cleaver, the author of Soul on Ice, had gone there. And there was a little commune. They occupied a villa in Algiers. And that's why Roger Holder decided to go there. He thought he would crash with the Panthers. He gets there, and almost immediately, things start to go badly. This is a time when the Eldridge Cleaver, a very strong personality, to say the least, is kind of running afoul of the president of Algeria. There is a dispute over the money that Roger and Kathy bring to Algiers. Eldridge Cleaver wants the money. The Algerian government seizes it. So there's a lot of disputes, and the Algerians start to crack down on the Panthers, and the Panthers are actually forced to, one by one, flee the country for their own safety. And that's eventually what Roger and Kathy have to do as well.
And that's where they wind up in France.
Yes, they actually make it to Paris, which is where a lot of these people went, including Kleber. And they find sympathizers in Paris, often wealthy sympathizers, who are able to support them and give them apartments to live in. And they start to make a life for themselves there.
Well, the government of France didn't exactly seem to be hard-nosed about these folks, did they?
No, not really. They eventually arrest them for the crime of illegal entry into France. They obviously didn't have passports, and so they're discovered there without passports, and they're arrested. And the U.S. government, of course, demands their extradition. And we do have an extradition treaty with France, except there's an exception in the treaty that says, you know, if the crime is political in nature, then France can decline to extradite. And so Kathy and Roger get a very good lawyer who makes the argument that the hijacking was an act against the Vietnam War and therefore political. And of course, the Vietnam War was very unpopular in France. And of course, there was a huge anti-American sentiment in the country at the time. And so this was an argument that held sway with the court and with the French public as well.
You know, before we get any further along in their life journey, I want to go back to their refueling and the decision that has to be made about passengers, because I don't think we can forget that on every one of these skyjackings, at least on the initial flight, there's a heck of a lot of passengers on board who are victimized by this and fearful for their lives. And I believe there was some decision where the pilots actually helped Roger, and maybe I have the wrong skyjacking case, decide who stays and who leaves, and they took one side of the plane as opposed to the other? Is that this one?
Yeah, you do have the right hijacking. So okay. This was the deal in San Francisco. When they get the new plane, you know, it comes time for the hostages to be released, and Roger's hemming and hawing and saying, well, I don't want to give away all the hostages because we're going to have to refuel in New York to get to Algiers, and if I don't have any passengers on the plane then, the FBI is going to come on here and kill us. And so he said, I'm only going to release half the hostages. And the pilot, one of the pilots asks him, well, how are you going to decide that? And Roger had no idea. He hadn't thought that far ahead. And so this pilot actually recommends, why don't you release one side of the plane and keep the other side? And so he actually makes a decision that, you know, okay, everyone on the right side, you can stand up and get off the plane. Left side, you know, we're all going to go to New York together.
That is really crazy. Let's talk for one moment about Kathy Kirkha. And what I want to do here is, first of all, ask you a question. Am I correct in remembering that neither one of these skyjackers ever spent any substantial time in a prison? Roger did, but it might have been for other reasons. I don't even remember that. But anyway.
Yeah, so he did. So Roger spent about 2 years in prison, ultimately, upon his return to the United States, which is, of course, for an international hijacking seems like a pretty light sentence.
I guess, like, you know, slap of the wrist or something.
Yeah, Kathy did not serve time in prison, no.
So I don't want to give away where or how Kathy goes on with her life, but I thoroughly enjoyed the very, very end of the book where you give us your take on what you think happened to Kathy Kirkha.
Yeah, I thought about that a lot. I thought about how to end the book a lot. Endings are always tough, and I definitely go into the realm of the hypothetical a little bit when talking about almost what I imagine or what I'd like to imagine she was able to do. And one thing that I write about time and again in my work is the idea of reinvention and kind of how reinvention is kind of the core of the American dream that we're all promised that one of the founding principles is that anyone can come here and no matter what happened in your past life, you can become an American and remake yourself. And I was fascinated by someone who, in Kathy Kirkha, someone who may have achieved that American dream, but perhaps not in America.
Well, it's a fitting way to end our interview, Brendan. I think our listeners can grab a copy of The Skies Belong to Us, Love and Terror in the Golden Age of Hijacking, because there's so many things we had to rush over in order to fit this into a 30-minute segment. But it's absolutely fascinating, and I'm glad you brought it to us. And thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our program. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.